This time on Weather Brains, Old Man Winter blasts the South.
The whole ice storm is winding down. It's just the cold weather is the story.
Trying to predict what will happen with wintry weather, well, it's not easy.
That cold air is really hard to pick up on the models. And then you got the moisture coming in across Mexico, and it just goes out into the Pacific Ocean.
Also this time,
we have gone nonstop since February 1st, 1885.
Brian Peters takes us to where continuous weather records have been kept longer than any other place in North America.
We continue to gather the weather records with the same tools and same techniques that we started using in 1885.
It's a Weather Brains Extra, the Blue Hill Observatory, living weather history. And we put James Spann on the spot about if he were to ever change jobs.
What is your next career going to be?
Check out what he says. It's all coming up. Welcome to episode number 51 of Weather Brains, the weather netcast that's all about the weather, produced by The Weather Company. How many times can we say weather in one or two sentences? Anyway, I'm David Black from Birmingham, Alabama. With me this time, James Spann of ABC 3340 in Birmingham. Mr. Spann, how are you, sir?
I'm invigorated by this Arctic air. I love cold weather. This is great. I live for these days, so this is good stuff.
Well, speaking of invigorated, I'll bet Kevin Selly in Texas, who's with us this time, is invigorated too, are you?
I don't know if I hold the same feeling as James. In fact, feeling, I'm just getting the feeling back in my fingers from this morning after being out taking pictures of the ice. It is just cold around here, David.
Oh, man, you guys have had really frigid cold. J.B. Elliott with us as well from Trussville, Alabama. Hello, Mr. Elliott. How are you?
I'm fine, and I vote for cold weather, too. I like it cold.
Yeah, you are a cold weather fan, and the big news from J.B.'s camp is that J.B. is now Mr. McElliott. How do you like your new Macintosh computer, I understand you got?
I love my new computer, and I love my new name.
Oh, very good. Well, we're glad to have you with us, and we're also joined this time by Mr. Bill Murray. Hey, Mr. Murray, how are you, and where are you?
Hello, David, in my nice home in Trussville, Alabama, right down the street from JB.
I find that hard to believe. Why aren't you on the road somewhere in Louisiana, Utah, the Virginias, or Florida, or somewhere?
I did my time in Kansas City. I warned them that it was going down to zero this week, and they didn't believe me. And tonight, they're finding out that I was right.
Well, speaking of some of the cold weather, and I'm going to put you guys, JB, maybe on the spot. James, what are some of the cold numbers that we have had across the central part of the U.S. lately in this cold wave?
I'll probably defer that to JB. I know that up in the Dakotas, I've seen some minus 20s, and I think some of the colder spots out there in the Rockies, JB, have been in the minus 30s. Is that right? Like West Yellowstone?
Yeah, West Yellowstone, the coldest in this whole series of storms lasting for a week or so, was 48 below zero one time, and they were 41 below this morning, and it was 18 below out on the eastern plains of Colorado at Greeley, which is just southeast of Fort Collins and north of Denver on US 85.
And you guys are talking about straight temperatures, not wind chill.
That's right.
Yes, right.
JB, are you familiar with Craig, Colorado, I guess? That's probably the entrance to the Moffett Tunnel.
Yeah, I've been up to Craig.
It was 24 below zero at 7 o'clock tonight, Central Time.
My word. Well, Kevin, you've had some real forecast challenges, I know, the past couple of days in Texas briefly. What have you had to deal with out there as far as knowing what was going to happen?
Boy, it was really tough, David, you know, because this cold air is so thin. I mean, we were at freezing or below for pretty much all day when the rain and the freezing rain was coming down. But you go up just 2,500 feet, and it was 60 degrees, which actually had an interesting effect of trying to bring some of that warmer air down through the colder air. And that kept temperatures up a little bit, so we had sort of a mix of rain and freezing rain in the Dallas-Fort Worth area for a while on Monday, which was actually a holiday. Of course, it's MLK Day, but the Dallas Police Department responded to 240 accidents just in the Dallas area, and that was on a day where not everybody was on the roadway, so that was just staggering. But from a forecast standpoint, that cold air is really hard to pick up on the models, and then you got the moisture coming in across Mexico, and it just goes out into the Pacific Ocean. You can't see it out there on the model, so you just almost have to just look at the satellite picture and go, oh, it's out there to Hawaii, and it's coming on in, so we just watch it come that way.
So, James, if anybody's got any traveling that they'll be doing from the Alabama-Mississippi area north into the plains, anything they need to be looking out for, watching out for in the next few days?
I'd stay away from eastern Oklahoma for the next 3 months, probably. I mean, they really got hammered out there around Muskogee and places like that. I mean, some people might be without power for many, many days, but the whole ice storm is winding down. It's just the cold weather is the story. And I wanted to ask Kevin, how did you handle this at your channel, at the cable channel, and how did your sister station, their Channel 8, handle all of this?
Well, the cable channel is a little different animal in that we tend not to get too specific to any one area and offer a little broader area, sort of thinking, okay, if you're in San Antonio watching and you want to know what's going on in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, you do some of that, but you also do San Antonio weather at the same time. The broadcast station, in fact, most of them in the market, they, for a good portion of the day on Sunday, were on, well, really through the morning. It was, you know, one traffic accident after another, and how much ice is on this power line and this tree and where the power is going out. And the power outages really started in the late afternoon and on into the evening hours on Sunday. And so everybody was all over it. But from TXCN's perspective, we try and stay a little bit more broad while trying to do some specifics, you know, as we can along the way.
Well, while we've got you on the line here, Kevin, I want to talk to you about something else that goes back to a previous Weather Brains netcast, and that was a discovery that Bill Murray made. Bill, you want to refresh us just a little bit on the poster that you just happened to notice had a little bit of something unusual about it?
Well, I have to admit, David, I haven't spent a lot of time worrying about the movie The Inconvenient Truth or an Inconvenient Truth, but when I came across the movie poster, I thought that it was a misprint. And so I started, you know, searching around the web, went to the official website and went, oh my goodness, the supposed hurricane that's coming out of the smokestack on the movie one sheet is rotating the wrong way. And so I thought I would put it on our blog and, you know, maybe get a little attention. And boy, I tell you what, you know, I really thought I'd get some ugly comments, but everybody was, you know, pretty funny about it. And then Kevin picked the ball up and ran with it in a great way and proved that, you know, I'm sure we weren't the only people that noticed this, but yeah, we were certainly one of the few.
I tell you what, good catch there, Bill. So, Kevin, you made, as I understand, you started kind of looking into this, asking a few questions.
Boy, this turned into a real journey, and I've shared part of it with some of you guys, but I want to share it with everybody as well. When I saw that thing, I thought, okay, this deserves an explanation. So I started calling former Vice President Al Gore's office and immediately got to his receptionist, and I explained to her what, you know, I was calling about, and she just sort of hemmed and hawed and seemed a little surprised, and as she was trying to collect herself, she reminded me that the former vice president is, in fact, very knowledgeable in environmental issues. And then she referred me to two of their people. One was a Josh Cherwin and a Kaylee Kreider, who is the communications director. And she said, you know what you need to do is you need to email these people. So I did that. And I sent the email, which I said the switchboard operator at Vice President Gore's office told me you might be able to help me with an information request concerning that movie, the Inconvenient Truth movie. And I waited about an hour. And I got a note back from this Josh Cherwin, and he said, please email me the request. And I said, okay, thank you very much. In addition, I would like to speak to someone, if possible. The question is about the artwork for the movie poster and the DVD case. The hurricane that develops from that smokestack that Bill referenced is rotating in the wrong direction. Tropical systems in the northern hemisphere rotate counterclockwise, where the poster storm is rotating clockwise. So I waited about an hour, and then I got a note back. I said, thanks. It's an extremely hectic time. Please email me your needs. Which I thought I had just done, so I said, thank you. I was seeking a comment on the error, please. Our listeners are weather enthusiasts, and hurricane rotating the wrong way certainly jumps out as something that we would be interested in. So an hour went by, and I got a note back, said, I have CC'd our communications director, Kaylee Kreider, to assist you. And then about an hour later, I got a note from her. I said, dear Kevin, the film highlights storms in both hemispheres. Cheers, Kaylee. And that was it. So I went on from there, and I sent a nice note asking for an interview. And I said, you know, I saw the movie. I wanted to know more about some of the features of the movie, the things that were going on. And I assured her that I would not even ask about the poster if we were to be granted an interview. So no response. So the weekend goes by. I pick up the next week, and I sent her a note. I said, may I please follow up on the interview request? Any information you can provide is appreciated. Thanks very much. Have a great day. About half a day goes by. Hi, Kevin. Unfortunately, we are not scheduling any interviews this month. Please accept my apologies. Now, at the same time, I started calling Paramount Pictures because they're the ones that distributed the movie and were ultimately responsible for creating that poster. So call number one went like this. Let me check on that, and I'll get back to you. Didn't hear back. Call number two. Oh, yes, I spoke to them, and I still don't know who them was at this point. They are aware of it, and know it was a mistake. I'll get someone and get back to you. No one calls. A couple days later, that gal, she was conveniently gone. So I spoke to a new guy, had to start over again, explain the whole thing. He says, I'll get back to you. No response. Call number four. He says, oh, let me talk to someone and everybody can join me. I'll get back to you. Nothing from him. Call number five. Oh, yeah, let me find out. I'll send you a note. No note comes. Few more days goes by. The original gal is back, and now I have the name of the senior vice president for creative for Paramount, and she was going to check on that. Nothing from her. Now, keep in mind that I am in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, central time zone, where I have a job to attend to in the afternoon. They are in Los Angeles in the movie business, where I think they work from about 11:30 to 1:30 each day with an hour for lunch. So on the final call, I get, oh, I'm glad that you called. I was just about to send you a note. Unfortunately, our guy is not available and is going out of town, so he needs to decline your offer for an interview. He thanks you anyway. He is just not available to take interviews now. We're getting ready for Sundance, which I think was supposed to impress me. So I'm sorry, but good luck with the program. So I asked for a comment from someone and was told they didn't comment on their campaigns. The best she could do was to send me to the publicity department if I needed a comment, at which time I said, yes, please, and I was treated to the soundtrack from what I think was the movie for Dreamgirls for a period of time that now actually means I don't have to go and see the movie because I listened to the whole thing.
Oh, my goodness.
And the saddest part of all is the lesson that I have learned is that now I will not be able to read any more of Bill's posts on the blog because I just don't have time.
Good grief.
Man, you are a tenacious bulldog, pal.
For a journey.
Oh, my
goodness. You'll make an excellent reporter for the National Enquirer.
You've got what it takes, Kev. That's an interesting trick.
Well, and believe it or not, I'm not sure I've given up, so I'll report back.
Well, if anything else happens, we expect updates on the Inconvenient Truth poster.
Well, thanks a lot, Bill.
Yeah, Bill, it's all your fault, Mr. Murray.
I thought it would just be a nice, simple little blog post, and it's turned
it
into
was for most.
Yeah, look what you started. And interestingly, with all of the debate that goes on about what that movie is about, and we've talked about that many times on Weather Brains. One thing that I think does come through very important to both sides is the importance of monitoring climate and knowing where it goes. Fair statement, James?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the more data we get, the more we will know. We've still got a long way to go.
And one of the points that some scientists, and I'm not trying to get into the argument again, but one of the points that is made in these arguments about man-made global warming is how much history that we have to rely on to know as accurately as possible about what the real climate trends, tendencies in the world are. And quite frankly, the argument is made time and time again that it's pretty limited. So when you have a place on the Earth that has weather records going back a long time, that's something pretty special and something of great value. Well, it was an avid interest in weather that prompted Abbot Lawrence Roach to establish a private scientific center for the study of the atmosphere. And get this, guys, this was way back in 1885. The Blue Hill Observatory, not far from Boston, has been the site of many pioneering weather experiments and discoveries, including the earliest soundings of the atmosphere through instrumented kites. Well, Brian Peters talked with Don McCasland. He's the program director at the Blue Hill Observatory about this unique facility. This is a Weather Brains Extra, living weather history. Now, how's this for consistency? Don says Blue Hill's weather observation equipment has been operating, you ready for this? 24 hours a day, every day, for more than 120 years.
Mm. We have gone nonstop since February 1st, 1885, gathering weather records. And one of the key things is that we continue to gather the weather records with the same tools and same techniques that we started using in 1885. We have a Campbell-Stokes sunshine recorder that was built in the 1990s. It's designed, built, and calibrated to the exact same scale and style as the original one, which was built in the 1800s. in the 1880s, and we do that with our mercury barometers. We have the oldest continually used mercury barometer in all the United States. It's been here since 1887, and we still use it every single day.
Does anybody else anywhere in the country use mercury barometers anymore?
Yes, mercury barometers are still considered one of the best standards for accurate measure of air pressure. So it's not that we are the only ones in the country using mercury barometers. There are other folks who use mercury barometers. For example, Mount Washington Observatory in New Hampshire has the second oldest continually used mercury barometer in the United States. Theirs dates back to 1947. So they are used at other sites than just here at Blue Hill Observatory, and mercury barometers are very, very precise. We also have the modern digital equipment. We have the automated surface observing system of the National Weather Service. So we have the most modern techniques available working right alongside the homogeneous systems that go back to 1885.
So I guess you can address the issue of modern-day equipment's accuracy versus the old-style but highly accurate equipment from long ago.
That is correct. One of the best examples is the previous ASOS rain gauge, which was a tipping bucket style of rain gauge. And because we were able to compare it right alongside an 8-inch standard gauge rain gauge, we were able to find that the ASOS rain gauge had an inaccuracy of 15 to 20%. So when the National Weather Service came up with a better rain gauge, they installed it here in one of the first places because they knew that they would be able to do really accurate comparisons. And their new rain gauge is within 3%. So that's a huge, that's a 500% improvement over the previous automated rain gauge.
Oh, yes. Anybody in weather knows that tipping buckets are notoriously bad. When the rain gets coming down, as it does in the south, coming down too fast, that little bucket just can't do enough work.
Exactly. And so the now we have a weighing gauge with an electronic scale, and it is much more accurate. It's within 3% of the standard gauges. So they're very pleased that the performance is so good and that we are able to track and monitor the new equipment and provide them with the long-term climate data, such as our passage of wind. We use a contact-making anemometer. And again, it's designed, built, and calibrated to the exact same scale as the one we had in the 1880s. So when we do long-term comparisons of the wind speed, we know whatever differences we see are true climate differences, as opposed to, oh, it's being measured a different way, so that's why the numbers are different.
Well, let's get back to the history a little bit. I'm familiar, having been raised in New England, I'm a little familiar with you, but I'm sure many of our listeners may not. Where exactly is Blue Hill Observatory?
Blue Hill is actually part of a small series of hills called the Blue Hills, and Great Blue Hill is the tallest of them all at 635 feet above sea level. We're 10 miles south of Boston, and we are one of the highest hills on the entire eastern plain from New Hampshire to Florida. It started out as a private operation. Abbot Lawrence Roach was just 24 years old, had graduated from MIT, and his parents said, well, now you're a college graduate, what are you going to do with your life? And he had been a weather fanatic since his young teens, journaling the weather and recording it and studying it very extensively. He had had the opportunity to travel to Europe with his grandparents and parents and seen weather research stations there. So he said, I want to open a weather research center and observatory here in the United States, because there really weren't any. There were lots of observatories, primarily at ports around the country, but there weren't any meteorological study centers, and he wanted to create one. So he was able to build the structure for just over $3,500, and it opened February 1st, 1885. He ran it as a private enterprise until 1912. He had been working with Harvard as an associate professor of meteorology for several years from 1885 through 1912, and he bequeathed the observatory to Harvard, who operated it from 1912 until 1971. And then Harvard gave the building to the state of Massachusetts, who owns the reservation that surrounds us. It's a 7,000-acre reservation called the Blue Hills Reservation. the state proceeded to lease the building to the National Weather Service, who had been here several decades before in conjunction with Harvard.
Uh-huh.
And the National Weather Service operated the observatory from 1971 until 1999. In the 90s, when they installed the ASOS system, the Automated Surface Observing System, they felt that they didn't need the observers here anymore, and they were going to shut down the daily manned observations in favor of exclusively using ASOS information. Luckily, some historians, members of the club, the Blue Hill Observatory Weather Club, state and National Climate Archives and National Weather Services staff said, wait, we really need to keep the manned observations going because their homogeneous records and the techniques and tools used are valuable that we need to continue and perpetuate. The state was able to get a $1 million grant to refurbish the building. The National Weather Service agreed to a contract to continue to support the observers' work and to house their automated surface observing system. And the club, the Blue Hill Observatory Weather Club, took over the day-to-day operations, and we've been running it since May 1st, 1999.
Wow, a very long and distinguished history.
Hey, Don?
Yes?
When Mr. Roach started this, he had a lot of problems making all this work the first year or two with weather difficulties and all kinds of temperature extremes. This was not a real smooth thing to start off with, was it?
No, there were several different problems. The building itself had a lot of problems with leaks and drafts and keeping it comfortable for the observers to work. So there were a lot of structural problems that they were dealing with constantly. Instrumentation in terms of learning what type of instruments worked here well, and that performed consistently. There was a lot of struggles with the instrumentation. The funding, because he had to figure out beyond his family money how he could make it feasibly funded and operating with staff and equipment and everything like that. So that was all a struggle. But he was very lucky to have the support of a wide range from Harvard, from MIT, from friends and family. And as his information started getting out there and people realized that he was sincere and serious and he was gathering information that was valuable, then he started getting invited to different places to present lectures on what was learned at Blue Hill. But like many, many ventures, it did have a bumpy start, and it's had a few bumpy roads along there. It was very strong possibility that it was going to be shut down in the 90s, and we were very lucky that a group of dedicated staff and volunteers were able to come together and pull it through. And we have accomplished some amazing things. Some of the first records of the upper atmosphere using a kite meteorograph was done here at Blue Hill, especially in the 1890s. They would lift tools, the meteorograph graphed the humidity, the temperature, the altitude by using the change in air pressure and frequently wind velocity. And those kites would lift the meteorograph anywhere from 10,000 to 15,000 feet above sea level. And this was some of the first study of that level of the troposphere done anywhere in the world. The information was so valuable that a worldwide establishment was made of that information. And that also helped to lead to the development of the weather balloons, especially in the 1930s.
Were these the... Don, were these the same kind of kites that were used in Oklahoma? I know, having been in the weather business for almost 40 years, I've seen some of the pictures of the old kite stations out in Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
Were these the same kind of large box kites?
That's right. There's basically two styles of kites used here at Blue Hill. Diamond-shaped ones, primarily designed or inspired by William Eddy from New Jersey, and then the box kites, which were variations of the Hargraves box, and there's actually a specific design called the Blue Hill box that used a different strut system than the Hargraves system. And the U.S. Weather Bureau kites are primarily more of the Hargraves design than the Blue Hill design, but size-wise they're very similar. Here at Blue Hill we used three different sizes. The smallest was 4 foot by 4 foot by 18 inches, the medium one was 6 foot by 6 foot by 24 inches, and the large ones, which were used the most often, were 8 foot by 8 foot by 36 inches. So they were big, serious, powerful kites. They required line that was 1,000-pound tensile strength to ensure that it wouldn't snap, because the meteorographs being lifted weighed anywhere from 2 pounds to over 15 pounds.
So you had a metal wire, so you didn't do any kite flying in thunderstorms like Benjamin Franklin, huh?
We certainly tried not to, although there was study of electricity in the air done by putting foil-covered kites up into the air, and that was actually the first studies before we did the meteorographs, and flying, say, on a dry day, letting the air go by and the static electricity build up, and then measuring those charges. There was one time when a lightning storm came through while the kites were flying, a little bit unexpected, and a charge did come down the line to an engineer on the ground. He got blown back about 10 feet. He stood up, he walked into the observatory, picked up all of his equipment, walked home, and he was never seen again.
Is there a kite station still there?
Well, there is a little bit of a problem that we didn't have in the 1890s. The maximum altitude we're allowed to fly kites at now is 200 feet, and we frequently do fly kites here. One of the very popular programs we have is a kite-making workshop where students learn how to build their own kites, and we fly them. But 200 feet above the summit, 800 feet above sea level, isn't high enough to really do any valuable atmospheric study. We're within flight paths to both Logan Airport and another local airport called Norwood Airport, and that's why we're allowed no more than 200 feet above the hill.
Gotcha.
When you have weather information on a continuous basis going back more than 100 years, what is the value of that in a weather forecasting sense?
Probably the most value in a forecasting sense would be that all that information can be used to get plugged into models. And the more information put into a modeling system, the greater variety of information that can be done. And so, you know, the more info in, the more accurate the modeling can be. So that's probably the biggest contribution from a forecasting point of view. The largest contribution would be the climate study that we offer. And we're what's called a benchmark climate station, because when you're looking at things like global warming, which of course is big in the news nowadays, or other trends, being able to know that whatever trends you see are definitely weather and not affected by instrumentation or different industrial development in the area or things like that, to know that we have lots and lots of controls in terms of location, reading techniques, equipment, etc. All those controls make the variables much more limited, and the variables are primarily the weather. So it allows us to do excellent climate study. That's the biggest benefit.
As far as the past 100 years or so are concerned, is Blue Hill in a state of global warming, cooling, or staying steady?
No, it is definitely warming. The rate for the total time is almost 3 degrees.
Interesting. What about folks who want to find out more about you guys? Can they visit you? And you have a web presence too, right?
That's right. The website is www.bluehill.org. And we are open for tours at this time of year, Monday through Friday, most days from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., depending on staffing availability and scheduled programs that we do. We offer the scheduled program 7 days a week, every day of the year, and people can phone me at 617-696-0562, and we can describe those programs. We have programs that are appropriate for pre-K all the way through adult.
Now, Blue Hill is actively working to expose young girls to the sciences by operating a program called WINS, Women in Natural Sciences. The program exposes girls in middle and high schools to career opportunities in a variety of science fields, including geology, astronomy, and other natural sciences, as well as meteorology. Pretty cool place, and I'm excited, too, to see programs like that to get young people into science, because we need them in scientific careers.
That was really interesting. I thought the kite thing was fascinating. 15-pound instrument packs on that thing? I just can't begin to imagine that.
I know. That's awesome. I'd love to go up to that place and just see that. You know, to see history like that, you don't run across many places that have kept records, have done anything for that matter, so consistently and so continuously for such a long period of time. You want to head up there, James, in the Weather Brains van?
I think we ought to crank up the Weather Brains corporate jet and just all go up there.
There's some neat pictures on the website. I was just looking through there while we were listening to that, and it's a really unique looking building. It's almost castle looking. So I highly recommend the website and the pictures of that. I've kind of got this mind picture now of David and James back in the day when they were working together, standing on top of Red Mountain with a kite with their Macintosh computer tied to it, sailing it over downtown.
Well, you know who else would be in on that would be Bill Murray, because he is such a weather historian. He'd be on top of that from day one.
Yes.
No comment, Bill?
And I met an old friend of yours today who said to tell you hello, David. I'm sure everyone else that's on the call will remember.
Uh-oh.
Ray White, who was weatherman at Channel 42 back in Birmingham in the day. I had a great 2.5-hour lunch with him today, and he said to tell everyone hello. So I'll have some stuff on the blog about him this weekend. He's an interesting fella, and predated James by about 4 or 5 years in Birmingham.
Yeah, to, James, you
really
remember.
Really bringing weather to the masses.
You remember Ray White, James?
I thought he did a great job. Now, didn't he have a funeral home business on the side or something?
Yeah, he's very funny, because he told me, he said, there were three things in life that I wanted to do when I was a kid. I wanted to be a G-man, I wanted to work in a mortuary, and I wanted to be on television, in broadcasting, because television didn't exist, of course, when he was little. And he did all three.
Wow.
He went from being in the Army to being on radio, then on television, then doing the weather, and then switched gears completely and, got his mortuary experience, and then went on to work for the Alabama Department of Forensic Sciences. And he said, he got the job in Montgomery because they said, we just don't find many people that don't mind being around dead people. So,
oh, goodness. Well, he's an example of, you set your sights on stuff you want to do, you can make it happen. Okay, James, what is your next position?
He used to come out to the weather service every evening. We were at 11 West Oxmoor Road, and trace weather maps and copy down data and get ready for his 10 o'clock news. I thought Ray White was his TV name. Was that his real name?
That's his real name, JB. And he's going to come to lunch with you and I in a couple of weeks and bring some of those maps. He says he has most of those maps that he drew over at the weather service on West Oxmoor Road back in the day. Because, as you know, what he would do is be come to the weather service about 7:30 and get a complete briefing before he went back to the television station.
Oh, wow. Okay, well, here he has made all these career changes. All right, James, we're putting you on the spot. What is your next career going to be?
Walmart greeter.
how well can you say, would you like a buggy, man? Let's hear you say that.
Man, put a yellow sticker on that, please, sir.
Okay. Hey, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
I think you have a possibility there. You have a career ahead of you.
JB's going to be the bouncer. You know, he'll be the guy tackling the ones that come through there. The little buzzer goes off, you know, like they're stealing merchandise. So I'll greet him as they come in, and JB will tackle them on the way out. He's the bouncer.
Well, I guess I might as well.
Store detective.
Yeah. I guess I might as well, confess what I've been practicing on, too. Kevin has, I think, as well, and that is, would you like fries with that? So we all have our.
I have something to fall back on.
Yeah. We all have our emergency backup careers that we can go to.
I just want to say to Bill that Mr. White sounds like a fascinating guy, but I hope you'll forgive me if I don't read your blog post.
Not going to open that can of worms, that's for sure. Couple of emails into the WeatherBrains email box. Thanks to Chuck Bittinger and Jeffrey Fuller for saying hello to us. Coming up next time on WeatherBrains. There's a lot that meteorologists know about hurricanes, and a lot that they don't know. Well, one of the biggest challenges is getting information regularly from the center of a hurricane, where the land and sea meet.
That air-sea interface, where the atmosphere meets the ocean, is where the energy transfer occurs. And if we really can't observe it in detail, we really don't understand the minutiae, and the important minutiae, I might add, of how the storm really gets its fuel.
Dr. Joseph Sion is a research meteorologist with the federal government in Miami. Sure, we can and do drop sensors into the eye of hurricanes, but that's limited, and it's far too dangerous of an area for people to be hanging around. So, what to do? Well, Sion has been taking on the challenge.
We want something that's going to be able to get low, do what we need it to do, but also not be too expensive.
Dr. Sion says there's an answer: by flying unmanned aircraft into hurricanes. So far, he says, the results look promising. I just see myself going down the interstate launching one of these off my Explorer, right? Not exactly.
That's what we use. We use a Ford Explorer right now, so there you go.
But the future of this new research technique is still, pardon the pun, up in the air. Join us for Flying into Fury. It's next time on WeatherBrains.
If you'd like to contact the Weather Geeks at Weather Brains, our email address is question@weatherbrains.com. Our telephone number, if you'd like to leave a voicemail, is 206-339-5482. 206-339-5482. A reminder that the opinions expressed here on Weather Brains are not necessarily those of ABC 3340. And some of the music provided during this netcast came from the Pod Show PodSafe Music Network, online at music.podshow.com. For the Weather Brains crew, all of whom are currently out on bond, James Spann, Bill Murray, J.B. McElliott with that new Macintosh computer, and Kevin Selly, I'm David Black. Thank you for listening. We hope you can join us again for the next edition of Weather Brains. Weather Brains is copyright 2007, all rights reserved. Adios. All right, guys, had fun.
Hey. I'm going to send you guys some ice cubes.
At 32 and freezing rain in Shreveport.
Yeah, just keep that icy weather to yourself there, Mr. Selly. We don't really need it here.
We are pushing it out.
Thank you very little.
All right, boys. I'll have a
blast.
Good
see y'all.
Bye.